And we are live. My name is Marvell. I'm the host of the One Gone Words of Wisdom show, created by the Honorable Tim Pool. And we're pleased to be with you once again. There are a lot of things we probably could have been doing, but none more important than spending our time with you and sharing what we have in store in our minds and in our hearts for what's best for our communities, for our culture, for our people, and for the United States of America. I'd like to preface, be first to let it be known that I'm a writer and I write frequently and I have a tendency to speak the way I write. And so as a result, I use a lot of words that are uncommon. And I'm working on making sure that I don't make it difficult to be understood because I'm really passionate about what my messaging is and what I would like for it to represent. So bear with me, and if I use something that that's questionable, call in and say, hey, what did you mean by that, or what does that word mean? Or if you want to take the time to Google it or whatever, because I will. I do have the tendency to use words that are not common, but just to charge it to my mind, not my heart. So this day is one of those days where Talk Tuesday, whatever you might have in mind to discuss, we have the time, so we can put it to the floor, discuss it, dissect it, trisect it, and then toward moving to the solution if it's a challenge, or if you have something to share that you think would bring joy to the listening audience, please share that as well. Because good news and good vibrations should also be a part of this broadcast, not necessarily always talking about the challenges, but talking about some of the victories. So we're open today for any subject or topic of conversation that might move you to put it to the air. So you have your opportunity starting now. In the meantime, before we start getting our callers in, I have a question to pose, and that is, We're in the grips, call it grips, of the demands for probably the most popular holiday in this country, and followed by the second most popular celebratory holiday, which is the beginning of the new year. I want to talk about the pressures and demands that seem to be always over, especially our folk, for this Christmas season, and I want to make sure that our children or our loved ones enjoy the opportunity to be gifted. And then if you remember, if you've been around a while, if you're like me, and like many that I've observed, in January, there's this feeling of, like, I'm going to say for me, it's a feeling of, like, deflation. I feel, wow, I'm glad, I enjoyed it, but I'm kind of glad it's over with, because now I have to regroup and recoup the investment of time and energy and the money that I put in to meet the demand of the holiday, but now I'm picking up pieces, and some of them don't fit the puzzle well, and I'm frustrated, and I'm kind of sometimes even I remember one time I was just kind of like went into like a depression after the holiday, and it wouldn't seem like that would happen, but that was kind of like what I felt. I felt depressed because now, you know, I've been off work, and now the bills are coming back, and they ain't never stopped. But now the bills are looking at me saying, "Hey, Doc, what happened to you?" And I'm saying, "Well, Christmas." And they said, "We don't celebrate Christmas. When you gonna pay?" So I'm going through this once or twice, and it kind of depressed me. So the reason why I guess I'm posing this to the floor is because there's another question in the undercurrent of what I'm sharing, and that is that there's another celebration known as Kwanzaa that's really supposed to be of our culture and designed by a member of our culture to take the days after Christmas and observe a principle each day. And those principles are very sound, and matter of fact, very much like the ones we've been talking about. See, self-determination, collective economics, collective work and responsibility. Those are three or four of those principles that are practiced in this celebration. And I ask myself, and I'm still asking myself, why am I not observing something that was designed by a member of my culture, has all of the principles or steers me toward what helped me to get in touch with my people and my culture and be traditionally practicing our cultural design? Why am I not excited about that? And why am I not carrying that message way in ahead of time so that we could be prepared to look at the option? Because, see, right now I might be introducing something to someone or in our listening audience who has not heard of it, and now you have to look it up. Or you have to, you know, do the research to find out what it is, what it consists of, and what are you supposed to do. And you might be ready to practice it next year because, quite frankly, you know, we're tapped out in what they call in poker, we all in for Christmas. So I guess I'm planning to see for something a little more like wholesome, a little bit more to the heart and spirit of our people to consider this year and prayerfully next year. Because these principles, let me give you an example. And maybe it's got something to do with the fact that they're in, I think it's Swahili. The names of the principles are in Swahili, and there's seven of them, seven principles of Kwanzaa, and they're called the Nguzo Saba. That's the seven principles, Nguzo Saba. The first one is called Emoja, which stands for unity. Then here's a nice one, Kuji Chagalia, which stands for self-determination. Then there's Ujima, that's collective work and responsibility. Then there's Ujama, cooperative economics. Then there's NEA, stands for purpose. Then there's Kuumba, or Kuumbe, that stands for creativity. And then finally there's Imani, which stands for faith. Now, in my recall, since we've been airing this last month, we've touched on most, if not all, of these principles as subject matters and as quests for us to seek out and practice. So it sort of makes sense. It sort of makes sense to give some attention to a celebration and a ritual that pays attention to all of these. First day, unity. Second day, self-determination. Third day, collective work and responsibility. Fourth day, cooperative economics. Fifth day, purpose. Sixth day, creativity. Seventh day, faith. And then you can also, they also have what they call a Karamu feast. And I think you can do it either the sixth day or the seventh day. But I'm going to tell you something that's really kind of moving to me, and that is on the seventh day, there's gift giving. However, the gift giving is not a marketed gift that you sell somewhere and you think somebody like or something like that, and you're sure that they like it because you like it, or you sure that they like it because it's expensive or it's nice or, you know, that kind of thing. But it's a different kind of gift giving. I'm going to give you an example. My son, my next to the baby, he's a gem. He's one of those kids, special kids that just got this persona about him. He's just a warm kid that everybody, when you get in his presence, you just feel him. So I'm separated from my wife, and she has custody. So I have to drive like half hour, because they lived on the other side of town from where I lived at. And I had to drive a half hour to get to him, and I used to come and get him on the weekend. So I came there one weekend. He was six. I came there one weekend to pick him up, and when I got there, he was woeful. He was kind of crying a little bit, you know. And I said, "What's wrong, man?" He said, "My mom won't let me go to my friend Charlie's birthday party." And that Charlie was his best friend. I said, "What? She won't let you go?" He said, "Yeah, she said cause she doesn't have anything to give me to take to his party. So I'm gonna be out of pocket." And then he said, "I told her I would give him my truck, cause I know he likes my truck." Now, this truck for him, and he's coveted that truck. He's taking care of that truck. It's almost like a monument. He doesn't even play with the truck. He likes it so much. He didn't want to risk breaking anything. And his friend liked that truck, and he was willing to give his friend his favorite truck. That's the type of giving that this celebration promotes. Giving something to someone that you know they like, even if you possess it and you like it too. So I'm just dropping this in as a considerable alternative to all of the push to spend a lot of money, spend a lot of time standing in lines and chasing bargains. And, you know, it's kind of like, it's a bit more involved than I think our culture deserves to be. Because we have, on the other hand, a cultural celebration that has us doing some reflection and looking at who we are and how we could learn to understand more about our background and understand more about our spirit and understand more about what our foundation is. And then at the end of it, you can give a gift to someone you care about that you know that they will like. Kwanzaa.
As beautifully said, you're on the Wise Words with Wangone Show with our host, Marvell Wilson. Mark, you are in the queue. Would you like to say something, Mark?
Yes. I appreciate those words about Kwanzaa, which I've never known. I've heard a few of them. And like Imani, you know, that's why a lot of people have names like that, because the names have meaning. We don't know what our names mean. You know, they were given to us because it's English or something. But, you know, I enjoy listening to that. But when it comes to the gift giving, see, that's the type of gift giving that God speaks about. It has nothing to do with Christmas. God says if a man walks up to you and say, I like your coat, you're supposed to give it to him. Now, that's what the words say. See, that's why I say so many people read this word, but they don't abide by it. They claim they love God, but they don't really love God, because if he said them that love me will keep my commandments. So, I mean, that's why I say we got a whole lot of rethinking to do. It's all about love. And I appreciate those words, Marvell. And grand rising to everyone. I digress.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. And grand rising to you, and good morning to you. Glad you're aboard this day. So, it's open. The floor is open for concerns, or as I said earlier, share something that's uplifting if you have it. Pour in to keep the balance, because everything is not dismal. Okay, so I said dismal. Everything is not a downer. Yet we address those things that can get us looking forward and keep us up once we remove the barriers and the obstacles that might be in the way of uplifting. So feel free to be a part of it in any way that you deem or think might have an impact on the bottom line, and that is, we're working strongly the mental atmosphere of unity and collectivism and brotherhood and sisterhood. So there was a time when there was no hesitation to say, hey, brother, hey, sister. There was a time. I mean, it might be far-flung from a lot of people, and they would have to look into a book, hopefully, and find the information still there, or talk to somebody who was there, and they would say, there was a time when there was no hesitation to look at somebody that looked like you, call them a brother and a sister. There was a time. We'd like to get back to that time.
Well, you know, that time is not as far off as it seems. It seems far because a lot of people haven't got on board with it. And I'm sure there's a lot of people that think about it, a lot of people that want it, but they just refuse to do anything to bring it to pass, to make it happen. And, you know, I've always been about unity. When this guy called him my friend, you know, he seems to be a pretty good friend. You guys met him. He's been on the air. Manny, when he bring up black cohesion. And, you know, that has really stuck with me, because there's something on Facebook that I've attached myself to. I liked a lot of stuff, so I answer a lot of things. But every day they always say black excellence. And like I say, black excellence is fine and dandy if it was based on black cohesion. But it's not. It's based on just what one person is doing. And that's just like just an asshole. Because you have no thoughts of love, no thoughts of caring, no thoughts of helping no one else. You just lying in your own pockets, thinking you have a ride, thinking you're better than someone else. And that's not the case. They look down on you even worse because you're just a token to them. So that's the thing that we have to come out of, thinking that we're better than someone else. We need each other. That's why God created all of us together. We need one another. And whatever faith you believe in or whatever, I know somewhere in there it says unity. Somewhere in there it says love. Somewhere in there it says togetherness. Somewhere in there it says hate no one. You know, so we have to really just get it together. And it's in all our hearts. It's in all our hearts. But because of what we hold in our pockets and in our purse and wallets, we refuse to love because we're scared by offering them love, they're going to want some money. And so we got to lose that concept. I digress.
Wow. You want some love. If you show love, then money it's got to be in the midst somewhere, huh? That's good. Hey man, that's kind of clear, you know. That's kind of profound. That when you express love in a manner that's giving, then I noticed that. And that the imbalance is just because I see it kind of regularly. The imbalance is mystical to me. How? And there's a practice, a group of people practice some principles, and they call it being in exchange. Being in exchange. So that means that when someone does something for you, that you be mindful to do something for either them or someone else, but to keep your exchange in order so that you won't be the recipient and anticipating receiving all the time and forget about your responsibility to the exchange to be giving. So, kids, and this is the last day. I just found out that this is going to be the last day. So we had this one day left. We've been working last 3 days. I have them on a project. The project is to create. I brought materials. We took a list of materials. And the project is to create something to be a gift to someone they care about. So now I brought paper for them, the special kind of paper for them to write in letters and to write poems. I had a whole bunch of stuff. I wondered, I kept them all the time because I knew it had some value because people don't do a lot of Christmas cards, strangely enough. But I had a stock of Christmas cards, so I brought them, and they all picked the card, and they signed the card and all that, so they're going to have the card in there. I brought materials for them to make stuff, like, you know, I brought colors, you know, markers and pencils and cotton balls and foam and all that stuff. And they're making these projects to give to somebody that they care about. Matter of fact, my wife sent some beads. We're going to make bracelets. We're going to, maybe not necklaces. We don't have time for the necklaces. Make some bracelets and some earrings, right? And all this is like, you know, creative, being creative about a gift-giving project. And so what I'm instilling to them is that there's a balance, the balancing act that it's important for them to start practicing when they're young, not to always just because they're under the graces of their parents, that everything should just come to them and they don't have to do anything. Because I'm kind of observing that a lot of that seems to be going on. with our young people. They've gotten to the point where there's a sense of entitlement. They seem to practice that they just got it coming, and they don't really have to do anything. And then being out of exchange, I think it creates the imbalance in the way we're going as a group of people, as a general society, especially us as a group of people, because if we have kids that are only anticipating what you're going to do for them, then I don't see any future in that. I don't see how that's going to benefit anyone but them, because their mind is set on only what you can do for them, and they kind of forget about what they can do for somebody else. I could be wrong. Matter of fact, I wish I am. I'd like to be wrong about that, but I've been observing this as a pattern. So the seed to plant is with the young people for us is giving, being a part of the giving process. And I think that would have to... Go ahead.
Right now, I agree with you, Marvell, on that point. But you, like I said, you have to understand, these kids have been taught, just like we have been taught, that you must earn things monetarily. Whatever you do, you got a monetary reward or something expensive. It's not the act of love. It's not the act of doing something because it needs to be done. This is your room. You need to clean it. So I'm going to give you something for cleaning your room. No, you're going to clean that room, I'm going to whoop your butt. Or you might not eat tonight. So that's what we got to get back to. Like I say, it's the thought pattern that these our kids have been taught in school. And we've been taught it, so that's what we teach our kids. And an act of kindness is giving something and looking for no return from that person. You're going to get your blessing on the other hand, on the other side. And see, that's what the Bible teaches you. Like I say, people read it, but they don't understand what they read. See, forever reading it, sitting in them churches reading the same thing over and over and over again, they don't understand it. And it says that in the book, steady learning, but never understanding the true meaning of what you're reading and what God is all about. But you give, if you ask me for something, I got it to give. That's a different story when you say, well, I'm going to pay you back. All right, I trust that you're going to pay me back. But in my heart, I'm not looking for it back from you because I know God's going to bless me somewhere else just by me blessing you or blessing anyone else. So you got to give ungrudgingly. And see, like I say, we get grasp hold of these things. We don't want to turn it loose. You can't take none of this stuff with you when you go. I've never seen a trailer hitched up to the back of a hearse. You know, although some people have died, had their cars buried with them, had stuff put in there. But believe me, somebody came back and took all that mess out of there. I believe they even come back and take the coffin out. Because when you see them digging up, they ain't digging, ain't no coffin down there. They resell them coffins. They got rental coffins. But you will be in a box. But like I say, that don't matter. When we go, we gone. But we got to learn how to love again. We got to get the love off all this mess we got. We love things more than we love each other. I digress.
Now, allusion to, okay, the reference to the Bible, after I rethink about it, that's a word that I guess you, I'm guessing that you are subscribe or you suggest that our people are the automatic followers, because you allude to the word regularly, and as if to say that, well, because it's written and you're not practicing it, you're out of sync. And I want to open up the potential of other practices and other written words like the Quran or the Lamza Bible. There's a lot of things based upon other people's beliefs that are principally sound, They just don't subscribe specifically to the Bible, although the words of wisdom are found in many scriptures of many denominations, of many other religions. So I want to sort of bridge the message that we're carrying to not be limited to just the word of the Bible. But principle is sound and clear once you observe the details of what it is that makes us be a part of humanity and what our responsibility to humanity is. And of course it's love. That's the ultimate. That's the ideal. So when we're talking, you give the overview, and then we shake down the details of how to get to the ideal way of thought and behavior. So,
well, my brother, just to clarify what I said early on, I said no matter what faith or religion that people believe in, it all says the same thing, love. But they no longer love one another because you've been taught to chase the bag. So you're chasing the bag, you forget about everything. You don't care about nothing but that bag. That's all, the bag. As you seen last night, for example, you know, everything, how people get so confused with money. See, money changes a person real quick, in an instant. See, some of mine ain't own nothing but money. That's the only thing that their mind is set on. And there's a lot of trickery in that. And see, so when a person is doing faulty things, they think somebody else is doing faulty things. See, like I say, I'm a good judge of character, very good judge of character. it's a gift that I have. A lot of times I don't say nothing. When I got ready to say, they kind of shut me down, but we did get my point across. You know, like I say, I see things, I hear things, I know things. God reveals a lot of things to me. That's why I say we have to lose sight on money and keep our sight on the prize, which is love. That's the only reward you're going to get when you leave here. See, because like the book says, if you get your reward down here, you got nothing coming up there. You know, I don't read it no more, but he bring everything back to my memory whenever I need it for such a time as this. But anyway, I'm going to let you go ahead on, my brother. I'm going to get back to work here. I digress.
All right. So again, the overview is, let's say, the overview is love and compassion. That's the overview, the ideal. And the question is, how do we, the bag, as Mark described it, take the bag out of the equation? How do we urge that temptation and the stimulant of the quest and the drive to have and get money? How do we supplement? How do we replace that drive? And what do we replace it before we get to the consciousness of love, compassion, caring, and sharing as fellow humans? How do we get to that? It seems to me that there's a certain degree of consciousness that's necessary in order to minimize the power of the bag or money as the driving force. So a lot of times I personally find myself not really feeling what I think I should feel when I invest my time and energy to something, and it might not see, because I don't spend a lot of money. You know, I'm kind of frugal about my spending, you know. I shop. I'm a pretty expert shopper. and because I like to have a variety of, say, for instance, clothing. I have a variety of clothing, but my shopping doesn't make it so that I have to go to these to get the high price whatever marketed. I'll wait until it gets low price. I'll even buy used. My budget says to me that it wouldn't be smart for me to outspend my budget on something that I can get for a lesser price if I waited or if I went to a thrift store or whatever I need to do, because I like variety and I like to be able to switch up and I like to be able to put things together and create with my wardrobe. You can't do that when you're spending all your money on an outfit, and you know, once you spend it, you're going to have to, you know, like find somewhere to wear it and only wear it enough for you not to look like you only got one outfit. So being prudent myself and frugal and economic, let's say I'm economic about my spending, I can see that on the other hand, a lot of people seem to be caught up with not being aware of what they're paying for, except the marketing, and then caught up in continuing to keep pace with the market rather than looking at their reality and saying, I'd probably do better than this. Let me look around and see if I could do better than this, instead of letting the market dictate to me what I do with my money. Let me step back and see what is the smarter thing for me to do with the money so that I can appreciate what money is designed to do. It's not designed to create envy, because that's what it seems like the practice is to create envy. If you got the new Jordan, and I got the old Jordans, you looking at me like, give them the old Jordans. And I'm thinking, I don't care. I paid $250 for these shoes. Whenever I got them, they were $250. And you paid $350 for your new Jordan. And so now you're trying to make my stuff look extinct when you don't know what I grinded for that $250. Or I put pressure on my parents for that $250. Either way, $250 is $250. But we'll look at each other. We're not with the times because we don't have the most recently well-oiled marketed item. And that's the examination that I see is not happening. It's to look at what it is that you're getting for your money. If money is the key, then let's find a way to make sure that it's working for us somehow. We had Thaxter Atterbury, a very renowned, very versed and well-spoken individual on financial literacy as well as investment and just how money works and how it should work for you. And he identified price and value. And then yesterday I told a story about a person that was giving away a refrigerator and put free on it, put it on his tree lawn. Oh, tree lawns, y'all don't have tree lawns here. But put it on his, because I'm from Ohio, we have tree lawns. But put it on out in front of his home, put a free sign on it, and it sat for 3 days. So he changed the sign and put a for sale sign on it, and somebody stole it. So price and value is one of those distinctions. Something can be valuable, but it doesn't have to have a big price. And something can be pricey, but it doesn't have much value. And we buy in pricey with not much value, because when we buy something, it automatically depreciates when we walk out the store.
Marvell. Hello?
Sir.
Yes. You're right, but let me go back to one of the things you said just a few moments ago. I'll use the word temptation. You're correct. We have been taught, bamboozled, and beaten about the head and shoulders about following, quote unquote, the ways and means of this society. So the market constantly makes a statement about the bag, and that's a true statement. Okay, how do we get back? By showing and teaching the value of that bag, good and bad, of the bag. And that's one of the areas that we don't touch on, because all of us are trying to get a few of those small bags so that we can sustain our existence. I constantly make the comment about self. You mentioned entitlement. That's the prevailing cycle of the country. So it can be very difficult to take a young person and try to show them that the $250 tennis shoes that you just bought, that money is not necessarily needed to be spent on that item. So it's back to teaching. It's back to teaching and showing. And people such as us, or mature enough as us, we were taught certain values during our earlier days, where those values are long gone. They're not in existence, because if they were, our language and mobility would be different. So, again, it's doing what you and Brother Tim are doing with the young, and hopefully they'll make it to our ages in this society. But it starts with the young.
Absolutely. And the young have a ability to teach the elders. Because I think I've shared this, that when a youngster comes home and says something wise or something sensible, or and it might be, you know, or unusually sensible. Let's not just say sensible. Let's say unusually sensible to the parent. The first thing the parent says is, "Where you hear that at? Who told you that? Where you get that from?" And so in that question, opens up the potential for one to glean from who has experience, or not experience, but who has influence enough to get their child to embody something sensible, something logical. So we're on this brink right now where children are being observed really closely by, and for whatever reason, but they're being observed by the elders and the guardians and, you know, the seasoned people attempting to figure out how to influence them. So they're the kind of like, they get a lot of focus, right? So when they say something that's enlightening, that focus can be the turning point in how the elders start looking at them and pouring into these children are talking about that makes sense. So I've got a little, I know that got a little convoluted. Let me say it in another way, is that when we, what we do is when we find youth that get it, we pour into them and we uphold them and we put them up under our wing and we delegate through them so that it's comfortable for their peers to get the message collectively. And when it gets collective, then it has an impact on when they go home or when they go back out of society, because they're walking in this. They're walking in this consciousness. So it's an inside-out job with the kids to the parents. It's an inside, it's an outside-in job for us to the kids and the parents, right? So we understand that. See, when my children were coming up, they'd be running around the store. And well, you know, I don't let them get too far. I ain't going to say running around, but they just be exploring the store. I had three children, stair-step children. And when I say, okay, come, so they all come. We get in line. And I had my elder boy was, he was a unique, kind of unique little dude. He would say, Dad, can I have this? And I'd say, how much money you bring? He said, none. You got money. I said, what's my money got to do with you? And then I'd say, I'll tell you what, if you want it, make me a proposition. What are you going to do when we get to the house to pay your half of it? I'll pay half of it, and you get the other half. What are you willing to do? And him, he was kind of resistant, so he would shut it down, but he got the message. That there's a responsibility. There's not an entitlement because I'm your father, because I go to work, and you see something you like or you want, and I'm just supposed to automatically bestow it upon you because I'm trying to buy your good graces, or I don't know what the concept is, but I make it clear that there is a responsibility on their end to get what they want, because I'm only responsible for what you need, son. I'm responsible for what you need. You have to be a part of what you want. So when they start talking, when they got to be teenagers and start talking about those they wanted those name brand shoes, and I would say, well, how much they cost? Back then, it was like they wanted $80, $90 for a pair of shoes, right? And I said, okay, well, $12 an hour. Those shoes cost $90 plus tax. So you want me to work, what, like 7.5 hours to get them shoes? How many hours you willing to work? Make me a proposal. Right. If you want me, okay, if you don't want to work, do the work to do it, write me a proposal and convince me of why I should invest in these shoes and what benefit is going to be for you and for me as well. And they stopped talking about them. They stopped talking about those names because the investment was a mutual investment. Sometimes they will be solely responsible for acquiring them themselves, and until they were ready to do that, they did without that stuff. They didn't have that much momentum for them after they recognized that they had to be responsible in some way.
In 15 years of working inside the juvenile system, entitlement and the worth of economics was the base of a program that we ran. The entitlement part was that the individual youngster who was at the time in San Francisco selling his weed and his rock cocaine and the drugs of the time, we began to talk specifically about how many hours, as you just said, is being put in and what is the profit bargain, profit line. And we built a concept, a thinking process around that. $250 shoes. Again, by teaching these young people two or three of them began to gravitate from the thinking that they were entitled to what they were earning by being incarcerated. So again, it goes back to being able to show that there are benefits to this type of thinking, but the consequences are also as numerous. Which one is of value? And it's not a difficult task, but it has to be consistent, as we always say. Thank you.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like, see, what we're doing, okay, so we're going into Grand High School with the young men there, and they are getting it. They are getting it. As you do the expose, they are actually getting it. They're recognizing the duplicity in marketing, and they're recognizing the targeting that's going on, and they're resisting. They're volunteering information to us saying, hey, look, no, I don't see, because I talked to them about the difference between being a successful business person and being a successful person. And they say, well, what's the difference? So that when they, even in that question, it implies that it's a likelihood that they think that they're one of the same. A successful businessman is one who probably focuses on one bottom line. That's to increase the coffers of his business and increase the money of his business, and that seems to be a focal point. Whereas being a successful person implies that your benefit and what you're anticipating is going to be valuable and your bottom line is pouring in to the hearts and the spirits of other people and being someone that people like to see you because they know that you have a glow of humanity about you that's going to help them feel better about themselves. That's a successful person versus a successful business person. So, hold on, I got to do this little thing. Am I there now? I think so.
Yeah, you are.
So
you're good.
So we draw these, We draw these distinctions so that they can look at what they're aspiring to and compare it to another option. Aspiring to, because we talk about the difference between power and influence. And they say, what's the difference? And I say, power is when you have a teacher come in or an overseer or whatever, you know, whoever is in charge, tell you, you need to stop talking or I'm going to send you to detention. Right? Or you have somebody say, oh, man, you want the floor? That's how I do. I say, when they talking, while I'm talking, I stop. I say, oh, you want the floor? Go ahead. What you talking about? Well, that's what I'm saying. You don't ask me what I'm talking about because I guess you have to ask me what I'm talking about because you don't know because I was talking at the same time you were. So I'm giving you the floor. If you got something to say, say it. Oh, no, I'm good. So the difference between the method is the influence of not only the method that I employ, but that's in the air. I'm not threatening you. I'm enlightening you. I'm stimulating you to give second thoughts to your behavior, not just for the what, but for the why. Because now you had the potential to have a floor, and you declined it because you knew that what you were talking about wasn't as important, or what wasn't didn't have the attention of everybody else that the person that was speaking had. And as it should be, because we practice a one mic system. But you want to talk while somebody else has the mic? Okay, what you got to say? No, I was just, well, okay, well, remember, we have a one mic system, and if you want to speak, raise your hand. But don't just start talking while somebody else is talking. So the difference is somebody will tell you, you got a detention. For you do it again, you got a detention. And somebody else will say, if you do it again, I'm going to give you the floor. And you share what it is that you thought was so important that you had to interrupt somebody else to speak on it. So this is what I'm talking about. It's like these distinctions help decision-making instead of a decision being made by a threat that if you don't abide by my decision, something's going to happen to you. The difference between power and influence, they're getting that. And once gotten, critical thinking kicks in, because that's something that we're not, well, I'm going to say we, I can't talk for everybody, but my what appears to me to be a sort of like a deficiency is the critical thinking thing, stopping and saying, wait a minute, hold it. Let me get this straight. This is what you're saying of such and such and such and such, such and such, such. Because let me tell you something. When I used to watch the con man playing three-card Molly and hiding the pee, they only did it to us. They only did it. They were in our neighborhoods working because, you know, the susceptibility to the con, because con is built on trust and in rhythm. You know, if you got a rhythm to the way you're talking here, yeah, you find it there, you find it fair, you find it there, blah, 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 blah. And be popping it while you're doing it, that rhythm, just like right now with the rap. If them guys were rapping without the music in the background, everybody would be like, what did he say? But because he got this good, powerful music creating igniting the musical aspect of our spirit, we with the music, and the words are kind of like subliminally being implanted. Because if you listen to Super AB, I ain't effing with you. Super AB, I ain't effing with what he say? If he was saying that without any music, without me being able to dance to it, and I just got to turn it on as a cappella, like, man, hold it, really, dude, really? But the combinations make it create the susceptibility for us. So critical thinking gets lost. It's like, wait a minute, hold it, what did he say? We ain't doing that. We're saying, it was cool, it was good, it was a good beat. Good beat. I remember I used to like, dance. I used to dance my butt off of I Got Five on it. And then somebody told me, say, you pay attention to the, I said, what? I just like that little, when it's intro, I like it. It's got the beat. It's got everything. I could dance my butt off of it. And that's all I was thinking about is how it inspired me to do my dance. I'm popping it. I'm bouncing. I'm hitting it. Because I could dance pretty good, well, at least I used to dance pretty well, and I wasn't paying attention to the lyrics, dude, talking about buying weed. I said, wait a minute, that is right. He talking about buying weed. Then there was another one talking about something on you. Girl, you know I can't hide it. On somebody, you're making it hard for me. Now, it didn't even startle me. The dude joking about he getting aroused by slow dancing with this girl, right? And it might be a girl that he just picked up and just said, come on, you want to dance? And they start slow dancing all of a sudden. And it didn't even dawn on me that this is what he's talking about, because of the beat and the music and all that stuff. I didn't stop to do the critical thinking. I just went with the flow. So I'm saying, it appears to me that that aspect is a shortcoming for us. And as we keep on peeling away at just getting to the details and exposing the marketing system, the anger, how anger is perpetuated in an unthinking mode, how, you know, there's a lot of, still a lot of this institutional racist structure that gets masked over. But when we stop and look, we can say, oh, wait a minute, hold it. Because that's all we're attempting to do right now is get people to stop and say, hold it, wait a minute, hold it. And wait a minute, you're telling me that if I do this, that this going to happen? Time this happens, when I do that, and the this happens, this don't match the that I did. Does you telling me you want me to do that again? I'm going to reconsider this time. Maybe I'll find something else to do. Maybe I'll find somewhere else to go. Maybe I'll patronize somebody else. Maybe I'll pay a little more over here with one of my people than to be insulted by you when I come in here. Because it used to be when the Arab stores start opening in our neighborhood, they'd be like, "Why you talking, you know, in their language?" And I'm thinking, and when I'm going, I'm thinking they're talking about me, how stupid I am or something. Oh, you guys, I want like it. And I'm saying, "Wait, what do you say, man?" "Oh no, $2. $2? Yes, plus tax." So there's a critical thinking aspect that comes out of breaking down and making clear the things that we're overlooking as a rule. And when they make sense, they just make sense. When you start getting them to make sense, that's our job, is to get these things to make sense so that a different direction and a different decision is possible and oftentimes likely. That's our job as guardians, elders, and seasoned members of our society, is finding ways to stimulate new thought about old behaviors and old games. I'm going to tell you, if I see somebody with 3 shells, I'm going to tell you up front, don't go for it. He ain't going to never be under a shell until he exposes it to show that you lost. But that's when he puts it back up under the shell, right there in front of your face. You don't see it, but he's moving that shell side to side so that he can pick up the shell, suck up the pee in his hand, cuff the pee, and then you pick a shell. And then when he shows you the shell that supposed to have had the pee, when he pick up the shell, he drops the pee. And it looks like it was there, but it wasn't there. So I use that hide the pee scenario to say that we keep going for the shell game when we don't have to. If we tell everybody where the pee is, they'll find another way to invest their money to try to double it up. They'll look at another option that might be available to say, oh, yeah, well, I ain't playing games no more. Let me get serious and try to find something that makes my money work. Because Thaxter Otterberry, when he visited us, he said, you have money and you have capital. Money suffices your overhead, where capital is supposed to be working to increase your coffers so that it'll be easier for you to take care of your overhead and have something to work with, to save, or to invest. So these things don't seem to be regular in our mindsets. And that's the seed that we attempt to plant, is that every time you get some money, it's probably not, I ain't gonna say smart. It's probably not strategic for you to always be looking to dole that money out for a thing or even a service. It might be prudent for you to weigh the value of your money, see if the service is affordable, and if not affordable, and if not, make a better decision about your capital and buy less for the product and have a little bit more for something to turn. You know, that we used to talk about turnover, you know, how you turn your money over. Same principle. You put your money in something that's going to work for you. We're not that good at that. And that's the seed that we want to nurture in the minds of the people that we want to influence. Because I'm not going to tell you what to do with your money. I don't even have that kind of power. I don't even know who has that kind of power. As a matter of fact, that's what marketing does. Marketing influences you. You don't demand that you go buy a product. It just influences you through visual aids and audio aids and through celebrities that you like and respect representing these goods and services. So the influence piece is very powerful. Now the power piece comes when you don't abide by the rules, and you defy the rules, then the power piece comes in. It's like, okay, well, you keep it up, we're gonna have to cuff you. You keep it up, we have to jail you. We keep it up, you be in court. Keep it up, we'll garnish you. So to avoid that, we must be more prudent and mindful about the difference between having your money and sufficing what your money is necessary, which is overhead, and having some capital to swing towards something that's going to help increase your money. And that's kind of like, I ain't going to say kind of, that is what we're imparting to the young people. Is that critical thinking by peeling away at the facades of all these other, the gamemanship. And they're looking at it and they're saying, really? Oh, I never thought of that. I ain't even, you know what? I ain't doing that no more. So sometimes steering someone from what they're doing or giving them something to think about other than what they're doing urges them to do something that's a beneficiary of a new thought process. And that's what our greatest hope is and what we do. That's what our greatest hope is here, is to stir it up and get it looked at from another perspective, get it looked at with some detail, get it looked at with some analysis, and saying, you know what, I don't want to keep doing that. And then we can conclude what to do after that. Okay, well, I ain't going to do that, so what am I going to do? Let's talk about it, and let's arrive at a general conclusion about what's smart to do. Okay, well, we ain't gonna do that no more, so what are we gonna do? Well, we're agriculturalists. Let's start investing in land. and start growing food, healthy food, not processed food, fresh food. Let us be at the farmer's market. Let us take over the farmer's market since we are the original farmers. We are the original farmers, right? I mean, for real. You know, we, the fields was our forte. So, and it wasn't just cotton. We were responsible to maintain a whole bunch of crops. So let's look at that and say, okay, well, you know, looking sharp with the shoes, paying the $250, and I'll get me a pair for $80. You know, go kick it with $70. And I still got $100 that I'm setting aside, waiting for the investment opportunity to get the $150 I just paid out to get it back. And think like that to start. Just think like that. Because being the one who get to be the first one to get, we called it straight talk with the young people when I was in Cleveland. And I was in the ministry called Set Free Ministry. Powerful little ministry. I mean, it was a powerful little ministry. Small sect, but powerful. So we had kids coming in. So one day a little kid came in, and he had this hoodie on. And all the kids were admiring the hoodie, and I'm thinking, what's up with this hoodie? Well, the hoodie was white, but it was made, sewn with some kind of gold, real gold flex in it, real gold, right? So then pulverized some gold and made it into some way you could sew it in. So that's what, because I was looking at him, I'm saying, man, there's something about that little thing. So we asked him, say, man, something about that hoodie. Tell me about that hoodie. He said, my cousin was in a contest, a rap contest. And the prize was this hoodie and some money. I said, oh, yeah, well, how much money? He said he won about $3,000. And he won this hoodie with $7,000. $7,000, he said. And he said, you know, he didn't want it no more, so he gave it to me. And I'm thinking, dude, what is you, 12? And you walking around with a $7,000 hoodie on with gold and embroidered all in it and all that. I said, man, ain't no future in that for you. I'm thinking. So I just got in touch with his parents. I said, look, please don't send him under our jurisdiction again with a hoodie that said to be, because somebody said it was $7,000 worth. And because somebody said it was $7,000 worth, it was believed to be $7,000 worth. So everybody is carrying that $7,000 hoodie message, and I'm looking at it, and I'm saying it ain't nothing but some cloth with some flex of gold in it. Ain't no $7,000 worth of gold in it, and it certainly ain't no $7,000 worth of cloth in it. So help me get with this. But these are the value consistent that don't make sense, but they're still consistent. That's what we're asking to be evaluated. Just like Christmas right now, people going into debt. And I'm going to tell you something. And I had a young lady tell me this, and it dawned on me, and when it dawned on me, it changed my perspective about this whole presentation. She said, you run around trying to buy in to a holiday that the people who benefit most from it don't even celebrate it. Jews don't celebrate Christmas, but they benefit greatly. Jews probably make more money in the Christmas season to carry them over to the next Christmas season so they can make investments and not be, they can calculate investments, or they can take risks because they have so much in their coffers that if their risks don't pay off, they say, okay, well, we'll learn from that. We'll take a blow on that one. We won't do that again. But we can keep on doing what we're doing because we know every year we're going to accrue this kind of dough because that's already in play. But they don't even celebrate Christmas. So to reevaluate, when Mark talks about the bag, talk about money, I think that's what he's really sharing. Not the fact that money is not important, but the value of money is being misinterpreted by us. The value of it is being misinterpreted by us. And if we can have any influence on the reexamination of that, that's what we're doing. That's what this broadcast and this podcast, or what is it, blog talk, blog, this is what this blog talk presentation revolves around, reevaluating what's really valuable and what is not. And let us reconsider. Within my heart, there's a want, full of mine, to open up their eyes and draw a clear and defining line between what's left and what's right, what's cold and what's hot, what's really important and what really is not. For the values we now praise and rarely ever choosing to question have woven their way through our culture and society by the mere power of suggestion. Let our desires not exceed our budgets in the stores and malls in which we shop, buying glued together shoes and man-made materials at $150 a pop. Let us cease to allow designers claiming to know what on us looks good for us to strut looking rich and prosperous to the backdrop of poverty in our neighborhood. Let us cease to allow those others to cleverly market us their wares, while our dollars fund all their ventures, and for all their trips, we pay their fares. So let us finally begin to reason that most of these values are just a mirage, like having a $40,000 vehicle parked in the street instead of a garage. Let us relax from all these pressures and no longer continue to contend that what defines our worth and purpose has to glow from without rather than from within, like the richness of a grape that's ripened beneath its skins belies its wines. It is what's beneath our shells and skins where our majesty best shines. For the sake of this country, for the sake of this country bridging to wholeness, let us recognize our value, and then let us demonstrate that value in the wholesome way that won't cause fear to anybody, that will create imani in humanity, faith in humanity, through our demonstration of recognizing and demonstrating our excellence as a group. And again, I say, we do it in a way that just makes it clear and natural that we're just being ourselves. We're not attempting to overthrow anything. We're not working against something. We're working for something. We're working to heal ourselves and the woes that exist in this country, driven by division, driven by classism, driven by prejudice. It turns into hate. Haven't you noticed? Haven't you noticed how practiced prejudice and discrimination turns into hate? Because once set in, it becomes easier to look at someone as less than, and in this case, human, less than human. And if you can deem someone less than human, then they can become expendable without any real conscience. But that is not us. We are truly human, truly human. And to demonstrate that and to let it be clearly known, we're going to have to work together to carry that message. Because our humanity and the recognition of it, I dare to say, would represent the road toward the healing of what's out of accordance with humanity in this country. So Consider those offerings, and look at yourself and recognize. And for those who have not recognized their gift, it's not too late. It's not too late. Sometimes I've noticed, even for myself, because my gift didn't catch fire, and I didn't have whatever, the perseverance to keep watering it, it sort of like lay dormant. And then it appeared like it wasn't there at all until something happened or someone happened in my life to say, hey, man, you ain't doing that? Man, you got it. You got it. What you waiting on? That's what I'm saying to you. You got it. What you waiting on? What are you waiting on? Pour into yourself. Look at yourself and pour in. Your gift that you let remain dormant, pull it back out. Shake it off. Shake it down. And start getting it back on point. If your gift is giving, people that just can't say no. Just have a difficult time saying no. And they're like self-sacrificial. They just, let me see how I'm going to make this happen for you. And I don't begrudge them. Sometimes I envy them for having that kind of mindset. However, I see that what seems to happen is that because it seems like they enjoy brainstorming to do for other people, that it seems to the other people that they're doing them a favor by giving them a new task. Or they're doing them a favor by giving them a new story for them to decipher and to find a solution for, or a new problem for them to help solve. And they're out of exchange. They put people out of exchange because now you're anticipating that the giver is enjoying giving, so I'm doing you a favor by giving you something to do, giver. But you expect me to do it? I'm not going to do the same thing for you because you're the giver. I'm learning how to be the receiver, and you're teaching me. You're teaching me. And then I'm going to tell you something I learned when I was working with young people. back in Cleveland, Ohio. I worked for the Collier County Advocate Program, CCAP. I worked for Center for Families and Children. I worked for Children's Incorporated. And I saw the same development or the same conclusion with most of the children that I saw where the parents doted over them, defended them, stood in the gap for them, everything. The kid couldn't be wrong about nothing. Gave them everything. And those kids were the most rebellious kids, most even got violent, cursed their parents, got violent with their parents. And this is what I observed. That when these parents are doting, coveting, sheltering, defending these kids, the message that the kids clearly was getting was that the parents thought that they were disabled or unable to do these things for themselves. And they resented that. They resented you not teaching me how to fish. You keep fishing for me. But you ain't teaching me how to fish. And I resent that because I feel I have something inside of me that you're not allowing me to express because you keep on jumping in the way and not letting me feel what I need to feel so that I can grow from what I experience. You don't let me have any experiences that I can grow from. I resent you. And they rebel. I mean, I've seen some kids slap their parents. And they had everything that another kid was envious. So, oh, man, why would you hit you? Don't you know your mama doing this and she do all that? And if the kid could be honest and candid and had the knowledge and awareness, he would say, yeah, and that's why I slapped her. Because she ain't giving me a chance to express myself. So we're in a... I think we're in a good position because there's a lot of things developing now, especially in our community. We got people who are adhering to Donald Glover's tune, Stay Woke. People are not just waking up, they're staying woke. And the eyes are open. If your eyes, you still got roomy eyes, and you're still trying to wipe it away, just be aware that some people, you can look around and you can see some people's eyes are wide open. And until you get yours wide open, just sidle up to them or get up under their umbrella until yours become wide open. Because the eyes wide open is where the creativity and the innovation and all the things necessary for change to happen. The eyes have to be, well, I can't say have to be. The eyes are recommended to be open to the existing circumstance. And we're on that turn. Right now, I'm meeting with people regularly who have their eyes open and have vision. They have clear vision about not 2 weeks from now, not 2 months from now, not even 2 years from now. People are visualizing like they did back in the day, our ancestors did back in the day. They visualize us being able to be in a school learning how to read when they were denied the opportunity by the threat of the gun and the threat of death. What you doing reading? Don't let me catch you reading no more or trying to read. But their vision was that we would have an opportunity to not only read but take the information that we read and gleaned from and be better people and productive members to help take care of our families and our society. So we have people now who are visualizing beyond their stead here. They're saying, I might not even see it. pouring into it because I can visualize it happening in the future for us. Got people doing that. So when that vision is there and it becomes powerful enough to be attractive, that's when we're going to be eyes wide open, deliberate. Yet, again, I say, not threatening. Not threatening, but attractive. Not threatening, but attractive. Because the militancy might be in the heart, but it can't be on the forefront. I can't say can't. I keep saying these definitives like can't. Can't means impossible. I'm not saying that. I'm saying it's not. It doesn't appear to me to be necessary. I'm going to tell you something I saw, and it moved me to tears. After the incident with Will Smith and Chris Rock, I guess 2 years had elapsed since the incident, and Chris Rock did his special. And at the end of it, he said, people were saying to you, man, why didn't you do something when he did it? And he said, because I had parents, and I was raised. And then he said, my parents told me, you know what my parents told me? Never fight in front of white people. And he dropped the mic. Never let white people see you fighting. And he dropped the mic. That was a mic drop. Never let white people see you fight. And that's not just white people. That's any other people. Never let any other people see us bickering and fighting. If we're going to do it in-house and iron it out. But never let anybody else see that dissension is so well-rooted in us that we can't even get along in public. We have work. But we have ability to do the work. There's no shortage of ability. Redirect these energies. Anger, resentment, bitterness, envy. Just redirect them. Stop. Give yourself a couple of breaths when you feel it coming. And redirect the energy. And give your brothers, your brotherhood, your sisters, and your sisterhood a chance. They're wounded. Probably just like you. And we are our own medicine. Reparations, as is deemed, I don't think it's properly worded. I don't think it's properly headed. Money is not going to repair us. We're going to repair ourselves. We just need to have the leverage that allows us to have the freedom of time to invest in that repair and in that healing. And just giving us, not giving us, awarding us what has been, as Joe say, earned, and as a result, just deserts what we deserve, will allow us that opportunity to do what we're capable of doing. That's healing ourselves. So faint not, folk. We're in a good space right now. Early on, Tim Pool put it to the floor. He said, with all these mass shootings, are we approaching end time? And I reevaluate the question to say, if we are near end times, is end of the time of the people who have misused their privilege, because 97% of these mass shootings were performed by white people, Caucasian males, killing people in abundance. So ending times might be in the undercurrent a message of the times of people who can just scoff off humanity for the sake of power and money. And maybe some people are deciding that they represent the reckoning for that kind of thought process. That's a possibility. But it's not end time for us. It's beginning time for us. As long as we can get to the point where we understand the value of what's within us and get our young people to start recognizing those values and having something to protect. The more you have to protect, the less risk mass shooting each other. Then when the eyes open like that, it's just going to be a wonderful thing. I just think and believe. I talked about it yesterday, belief. You know, having notions and aspirations and hopes and dreams. They're not beliefs. Belief is different. Because when you believe, I ain't going to say you, but when one believes, it's likely that they're going to commit to the fruition of that belief. Not stand back and hope that somebody else does something or hope that something else happens and that works in favor of the hope or the dream. But belief, having a vision and willing to invest in the vision, because in your heart there's a certainty that it's going to occur. So I believe that we're on a turn. I believe that enough people are going to demonstrate what vision looks like for others to be able to see. I believe that. And I'm a hard sell on a whole lot of stuff. I got a high standard for a whole lot of things. And the unity of my people has always been an aspiration, but has very rarely become a belief. But it is now. It's a belief. And I revisit the reparation because somebody else believes in us too. Somebody else. Somebody else was convinced that, you know what? You're right. I believe that. And you wrote a 1,100-page that substantiates your belief and why I should believe it. I can't say nothing against that, except if I want to, I can say, forget all that. I don't care how right you are. I don't care how reasonable. I don't care how sound your proposal is. I'm just ain't going to do it. Just ain't going to do it. Like Tommy Tupperville. He didn't want to sanction the armed forces to be able to activate their personnel. One man said, well, I'm not going to sign that bill. I'm not going to, I have the voting, I have the one vote power to stop that, so I'm going to stop that. And it doesn't make sense to anybody but me, but I got the power to do it, so I'm doing it. Even his own colleague saying, man, what you doing? And he's saying, doing what I want to do or what I don't want to do. They're both one and the same. So if it's not that, somebody just say, okay, well, I don't care. I ain't doing it. Other than that, it's clear that somebody believes that this is real and should manifest itself. So now the goal is to get us to believe it. And I know it's not an easy task, because we've been set up to be let down. I mean, yeah, it's easy for me to relate and understand why there's apprehension about the reparations proposal. Because it's like, why am I gonna get myself all pumped up about something and then at the last minute they might pull the string and what could I do? What could I do? Protest, march. And what else? But on the other hand, I don't see why the logic of the proposal, the deservedness of its consideration and its implementation shouldn't be rallied behind. Might not get to the point of belief. It's like you might not believe that the brother with the corner store got the best ice cream, but because he's a brother with the corner store, and you know that if you go somewhere else, he might not survive, you support him. You don't believe that you're getting the best ice cream, but you support him even still. So let's get to the support of the reparations project, support of it. And the closer we get to it and you start hearing more, you start seeing more, you start researching, you start talking about it, the belief will probably be assured on the route to it. But let's just support the truth in the idea itself, the truth in the written word, the truth in the people, the brilliant people. These are some brilliant black people who got sat down and composed a proposition to the American government, or at least to the government of this state, one of the most, if this is proven, well, I'm going to say proven, stated by someone, thanks to Arbery. He said, if California became a country like any other country, it would still be one of the most thriving, best economy as a country. It's just a state in a country, but if it were a country by itself, it still would rank highly as an economic force. So they appealed to and got approval from the state of California to go forth with an awarding of descendants of slaves in this state. That's something to pour into. Find out more about it and get inspired to support it. You don't have to be like me. I believe it. I believe it because it's reasonable. I believe it because it's human. I believe it because it was done before with others, before us. So I believe that it's our time. Just purely that simple. It is our time, recognition that we deserve. That, like Joe say, not just deserve, we earned it. We earned the recognition. Every day, thus far, last few several days, what I've done is I've put substance in our contribution to this country by reading off the inventions that black men and women created that has this country thriving now. The refrigerator. Can you imagine what life would be like in this country if we couldn't keep our food cold? Can you imagine that? Can you imagine not having a washing machine? These are commodities. These are staples. If you bought a house that was furnished and they said they didn't have a refrigerator, I don't have to ask that question. You can buy a house or rent a house, a furnished house, and they don't have to have a washing machine or a dryer. Then you go in a house and you go in the kitchen, and they say, well, this is the kitchen. It's got, got an island. It's got, wooden cabinets. It's got an oven, a high-tech oven. It's, electric, and it's a hole next to it with no refrigerator. What would you say? So I do this I haven't done it today, but I do this regularly just to point out there should be no fear, apprehension, or concern about rallying behind and supporting a reparations movement for the exception of the potential for disappointment if somebody pulls the plug. Well, I trust that they're not going to do it. Because I believe that if that happens, it's going to create a whole new movement in this country. If you dangle that carrot and you don't allow it to be at least bitten, shorten that string so we can get a bite to keep us going, it just doesn't make sense to me that there won't be that award. Just what are we going to do when it comes? Let's be prepared. Let's be prepared and let's heal ourselves. Once we have the opportunity and the wherewithal to present certain things that are necessary for our healing, to create certain things that are necessary for us to thrive and be recognized with equity in commerce, industry, distribution, so we can be respected as a unit, so that being lesser than won't justify, being thought to be lesser than won't justify cruelty, because that's how it goes. That's how Hitler did it, and that's how they did it in Vietnam. They had our men calling them gooks and chinks and all that stuff, dehumanizing them so that we can justifiably go over there and kill people we don't even know for a cause that we weren't even clear about. That's how the propaganda goes. So we're on the brink right now. What part do you want to play? You have an option. You have a choice. You can sit back and wait and see if it happens and be the beneficiary of it. Or you can help enhance and endorse its potential and show support for it, it's surety. So if somebody said, well, we offered it to them, but shoot, they didn't act like they didn't know it was coming. So well, I'll tell you what, we just give them a little something, and they ain't saying nothing. So whatever we give them, they'll accept. Or, well, we put it for you. You didn't want it, so we took that money and swung it toward the military. Or toward school. We helped your schools. Okay, we helped your school. And it'll be the same game like they did the lottery. The lottery was designed, 77% of the lottery money was supposed to go to the schools. What's your school look like? What's your school look like? Billions and billions of dollars since the 70s for this lottery thing. What's your schools look like? So you'll see that without building momentum to hold them accountable, you see what they will do with the money. They're greedy. They're greedy. So if they can pull the string on this and feel like won't that be that much blowback, don't you think they will? When I say they, I'm talking about whoever is in control of the purse string, whoever that might be. Don't you think that if you don't show that you have an interest in your own benefit, that they will take it away? Don't you think so? So let's get mindful, folk. Reparations is a likelihood, not a guarantee, but a likelihood. So let's respect that likelihood. Let's call that likelihood and raise it to a belief so that we can have what we need to heal our culture, our community, our people, because we're overdue for that too. We're not just overdue for compensation and awarding of monetary ability. We're overdue for the healing. And again, I'll say this, as my brother always said, in our healing circle, one side of the front of the shirt says, the healing circle. The other side says, we are our own medicine. Let's get our dosages in so that we can heal. Folk, let's get our dosages in so we can heal. Pause was for reflection to the last urging. To our listening audience, again, I will say it every day, that although this is a targeted message for a group of people in this country to awaken to some elements and to awaken to some factors, that does not exempt everyone else to do the same. Because once done, the benefit will be to the United States of America. Because as long as this dissension exists, as long as these divisions exist, as long as we have polarized viewpoints about money, class, under the frame of humanity, as long as those things exist in this country, you can say you're the greatest country in the world if you want to. You can say that we're the greatest country in the world. And a lot of aspects that might be true, but not in this one. When you have a marginalized group of people in here that everybody else could see, you can't claim to be the greatest country. You can just claim to be great and can be greater once you heal those who have been left out once that healing occurs, that's when we will be the greatest country in the world. I want to thank you very much for your audience. I want to thank you very much for being open-minded and considerate of the things that have been shared here. And I want to thank you in advance for your participation toward the goal of our unity in this country.